This is Audible.
Penguin Audio presents American Theocracy by Kevin Phillips, read by Scott Brick. Preface. The American people are not fools. That is why pollsters, inquiring during the last 40 years whether the United States was on the right track or the wrong one, have so often gotten the second answer: wrong track. That was certainly the case again as the year 2005 closed out. Because survey takers do not always pursue explanations, this book will venture some. Reckless dependency on shrinking oil supplies, a milieu of radicalized and much too influential religion, and a reliance on borrowed money, debt in its ballooning size and multiple domestic and international deficits, now constitute the three major perils to the United States of the 21st century. Shouldn't war and terror be on the list? Yes, and they are, one step removed. Both derive much of their current impetus from the incendiary backdrop of oil politics and religious fundamentalism, in Islam as well as the West. Despite pretensions to motivations such as liberty and freedom, petroleum and its geopolitics have dominated Anglo-American activity in the Middle East for a full century. On this, history could not be more clear. The excesses of fundamentalism, in turn, are American and Israeli, as well as the all-too-obvious depredations of radical Islam. The rapture, end times, and Armageddon hucksters in the United States rank with any Shiite ayatollahs, and the last two presidential elections mark the transformation of the GOP into the first religious party in U.S. history. The financialization of the United States economy over the last three decades. In the 1990s, the finance, real estate, and insurance sector overtook and then strongly passed manufacturing as a share of the U.S. gross domestic product, is an ill omen in its own right. However, its rise has been closely tied to record levels of debt and to the powerful emergence of a debt and credit industrial complex. Excessive debt in the 21st century United States is on its way to becoming the global fifth horseman, riding close behind war, pestilence, famine, and fire. This book's title, American Theocracy, sums up a potent change in this country's domestic and foreign policymaking. Religion's new political prowess and its role in the projection of military power in the Middle Eastern Bible lands that most people are just beginning to understand. We have had theocracies in North America before, in Puritan New England and later in Mormon Utah, but except in their earliest beginnings, they lacked the intensity of those in Europe, such as John Calvin's Geneva or the Catholic Spain of the Inquisition. Indeed, most of the Christian theocracies touched on by historians shared two unusual and virtually defining characteristics. First, they were very small in geographic terms. Second, and more important, they were the demographic results of migrations by true believers. The population of John Calvin's 16th century Geneva was swollen by French Protestant refugees, and the Dutch Reformed Calvinists of the Netherlands got a kindred infusion from Flemish refugees fleeing Spanish-controlled Antwerp. The Massachusetts Bay Colony, in turn, was built by English Puritan emigrants, and the 19th century Mormons in Utah represented still another Zion-bound migration. As for Spain, despite militant Catholicism and the infamous Inquisition, it was too large and varied a nation to fit the small-scale theocratic pattern. 17th-century attempts to shut down Spanish theaters, gambling houses, and brothels failed, and the golden age of Spanish literature and art, from Cervantes to El Greco, flourished in Toledo and Madrid under court, church, and noble patronage, despite periodic homosexual reports and scandals that the Inquisition did not greatly pursue. Theocracy in America is of this lesser breed. The United States is too big and too diverse to resemble the Massachusetts Bay Colony of John Winthrop or 16th century Geneva or even 19th century Utah. A leading world power such as the United States, with almost 300 million people and huge international responsibilities, goes about as far in a theocratic direction as it can when it satisfies the unfortunate criteria on display in Washington circa 2005. an elected leader who believes himself in some way to speak for God, a ruling political party that represents religious true believers and seeks to mobilize the churches, the conviction of many voters in that Republican Party that government should be guided by religion, and on top of it all, White House implementation of domestic and international political agendas that seem to be driven by religious motivations and biblical worldviews. All of these factors and many more are discussed at length in Part 2 of this book. The three threats emphasized in these pages could stand on their own as menaces to the Republic. History, however, provides a further level of confirmation. Natural resources, religious excess, wars, and burgeoning debt levels have been prominent causes of the downfall of the previous leading world economic powers. The United States is hardly the first, and we can profit from the examples of what went wrong before. Oil, as everyone knows, became the all-important fuel of American global ascendancy in the 20th century. But before that, 19th century Britain was the coal hegemon, and 17th century Dutch fortune harnessed the winds and the waters. Neither nation could maintain its global economic leadership when the world moved toward a new energy regime. Today's United States, despite denials, has obviously organized much of its overseas military posture around petroleum, protecting oil fields, pipelines, and sea lanes. But U.S. preoccupation with the Middle East has two dimensions. In addition to its concerns with oil and terrorism, the White House is courting end-times theologians and electorates for whom the Holy Lands are already a battleground of Christian destiny. Both pursuits, oil and biblical expectations, require a dissimulation in Washington that undercuts the U.S. tradition of commitment to the role of an informed electorate. The political corollary, fascinating but appalling, is the recent transformation of the Republican presidential coalition. Since the elections of 2000 and especially of 2004, three pillars have become increasingly central. 1. The oil national security complex, with its pervasive interests. 2. The religious right, with its doctrinal imperatives and massive electorate. And 3. The debt-dealing financial sector, which extends far beyond the old symbolism of Wall Street. In December 2004, the New York Times took up the term borrower industrial complex to identify one profitable engine of exploding consumer debt. That name does not quite work, but we can hardly use a term like the credit card / mortgage / auto loan / corporate debt / federal borrowing industrial complex. This is a problem still searching for its Election Day Halloween mask. In any event, the rapid ballooning of government, corporate, financial, and personal debt over the last four decades goes a long way to explain why the finance sector, debt's toll collector, has swollen to outweigh the manufacture of real goods. We are in the midst of one of America's most perverse transformations. George W. Bush has promoted these alignments, interest groups, and their underpinning values. His family, over multiple generations, has been tied to a politics that conjoined finance, national security, and oil. In recent decades, operating from the federal executive branch, the Bushes have added close ties to evangelical and fundamentalist power brokers of many persuasions. These origins, biases, and practices were detailed in my last book, American Dynasty: Aristocracy, Fortune, and the Politics of Deceit in the House of Bush. 2004. The present volume, therefore, revisits mostly the family's influence in helping these trends and guiding these constituencies. Over three decades of Bush presidencies, vice presidencies, and CIA directorships, the Republican Party has slowly become the vehicle of all three interests: a fusion of petroleum-defined national security, a crusading, simplistic Christianity, and a reckless, credit-feeding financial complex. The three are increasingly allied in commitment to Republican politics, if not in full agreement with one another. On the most important front, I am beginning to think that the Southern-dominated, biblically-driven Washington GOP represents a rogue coalition, like the Southern pro-slavery politics that controlled Washington until Lincoln's election in 1860. But the National Democrats have their own complicity. Their lack of understanding and moxie has contributed to the mutation of the GOP. Without that weak and muddled opposition, both before and after September 11th, the Republican transformation would have been impolitic and perhaps impossible. Clearly, the pitfalls of petropolitics, radical religion, and debt finance have to be addressed in their own right. However, I have a personal concern over what has become of the Republican coalition. 40 years ago, I began a book, finished in 1967 and taken to the 1968 Republican presidential campaign, for which I became the chief political and voting patterns analyst. Published in 1969, while I was still in the fledgling Nixon administration, the emerging Republican majority became highly controversial. Newsweek identified it as the political Bible of the Nixon era. In that book, I coined the term Sunbelt to describe the oil, military, aerospace, and retirement country that stretched from Florida to California. But debate concentrated on the argument, since fulfilled and then some, that the South was on its way into the National Republican Party. 4 decades later, this framework has produced the triple mutation that this book will discuss. Some of that evolution was always implicit. If any region of the United States had the potential to produce a high-powered, crusading fundamentalism, it was Dixie. If any new alignment had the potential to nurture a fusion of oil interests and the military-industrial complex, it was the Sun Belt that helped to draw them into commercial and political proximity and collaboration. Wall Street, of course, has long been part of the GOP coalition. On the other hand, members of the Downtown Association and the Lynx Club were never enthusiastic about Joe Sixpack and Middle America, to say nothing of preachers such as Oral Roberts or the Tupelo, Mississippi Assemblies of God. The new cohabitation is an unnatural one. Little was said about oil in the emerging Republican majority, partly because I knew I would be in the government when the book appeared. Still, oil men liked its political thesis, and I fleshed out an analysis still relevant today. That the nation's oil, coal, and natural gas sections, despite their intramural differences, would be regional mainstays of the new heartland-centered GOP National Coalition. Hitherto, these interests had been divided by the political Mason-Dixon line. That division would, and did, end. While studying economic geography and history in Britain some years earlier, I had been intrigued by the Eurasian heartland theory of Sir Halford Mackinder, a prominent early 20th century geographer. Control of the heartland, Mackinder argued, would determine control of the world. In North America, I thought the coming together of a heartland, across fading Civil War lines, would determine control of Washington. Wordsmith William Safire, in his The New Language of Politics entry on the Heartland, cited Mackinder. He then noted that political analyst Kevin Phillips applied the old geopolitical word to U.S. politics in his 1969 book, The Emerging Republican Majority. 21 of the 25 Heartland states supported Richard Nixon in 1968. Over the remainder of the century, the Heartland should dominate American politics in tandem with suburbia, the South, and Sunbelt-swayed California. This was the prelude to today's Red States. Mackinder's worldview has its own second wind, because his Eurasian cockpit has reemerged as the pivot of the international struggle for oil. In a similar context, the American heartland, from Wyoming, Colorado, and New Mexico to Ohio and the Appalachian coal states, has become, along with the rest of the one-time Confederacy, the seat of a fossil fuels political alliance, an electoral hydrocarbon coalition. It cherishes SUVs and easy carbon dioxide emissions policy and applauds preemptive U.S. airstrikes on uncooperative, terrorist-coddling Persian Gulf countries fortuitously blessed with huge reserves of oil. Because the United States is beginning to run out of its own oil sources, a military solution to an energy crisis is hardly lunacy. Neither Caesar nor Napoleon would have flinched, and the temptation, at least, is understandable. What Caesar and Napoleon did not face, but less able American presidents do, is that bungled overseas military embroilment, unfortunate in its own right, could also boomerang economically. The United States, some $4 trillion in hock internationally, has become the world's leading debtor, increasingly nagged by worry that some nations will sell dollars in their reserves and switch their holdings to rival currencies. Washington prints bonds and dollar green IOUs, which European and Asian bankers accumulate until, for some reason, they lose patience. This is the debt Achilles' heel, which stands alongside the oil Achilles' heel. Unfortunately, as much or more dynamite hides in the responsiveness of the new GOP coalition to Christian evangelicals, fundamentalists, and Pentecostals, who muster some 40% of the party electorate. Many, many millions believe that the Armageddon described in the Bible is coming soon. Chaos in the explosive Middle East, far from being a threat, actually heralds the awaited second coming of Jesus Christ. Oil price spikes, murderous hurricanes, deadly tsunamis, and melting polar ice caps lend further credence. The potential interaction between the end times electorate, inept pursuit of Persian Gulf oil, Washington's multiple deceptions, and the credit and financial crisis that could follow a substantial liquidation by foreign holders of U.S. bonds is the stuff of nightmares. To watch U.S. voting patterns enable such policies, the GOP coalition is unlikely to turn back, is depressing to someone who spent many years researching, watching, and cheering those grassroots. Four decades ago, although the emerging Republican majority said little about Southern fundamentalists and evangelicals, the new GOP coalition seemed certain to enjoy a major infusion of conservative Northern Catholics and Southern Protestants. This troubled me not at all. During the 1970s and part of the 1980s, I agreed with the predominating Republican argument that secular liberals, by badly misjudging the depth and importance of religion in the United States, had given conservatives a powerful and legitimate electoral opportunity. Since then, my appreciation of the intensity of religion in the United States has deepened. Its huge carryover from the 18th and 19th centuries turns out to have seeded a similar evangelical wave in the 20th and early 21st centuries. In 1998, after years of research, I published The Cousins Wars, a lengthy study of the three great English-speaking internal convulsions: the English Civil War of the 1640s, the American Revolution, and the American War between the States. Amid each fratricide, religious divisions figured so strongly in people's choosing sides that persisting threads became clear. Pietists and Puritans versus high church adherents, and a recurrent conviction by militant evangelicals from the 1640s to the 1860s, culminating in the American Civil War, that theirs was the cause of liberty and the Protestant Reformation. The overall analysis and its documentation were taken seriously enough that the book became a finalist for that year's Pulitzer Prize in History. Indeed, my wife and I were sufficiently impressed by the historical roles of the scores of 18th-century churches we visited, from the pastel Caribbean stuccos of Anglican South Carolina to the stone fortresses of Presbyterian Pennsylvania and the white congregational meeting houses of New England, to think of writing a book on them sometime. We still do. Such was religion's enduring importance in the United States when it was trod upon in the 1960s and thereafter by secular advocates determined to push Christianity out of the public square, a mistake that unleashed an evangelical, fundamentalist, and Pentecostal counter-reformation that in some ways is still building. As Part 2 will explore, strong theocratic pressures are already visible in the Republican National Coalition and its leadership, while the substantial portion of Christian America committed to theories of Armageddon and the inerrancy of the Bible has already made the GOP into America's first religious party. Its religiosity reaches across the board, from domestic policy to foreign affairs. Besides providing critical support for invading Iraq, widely anathematized by preachers as a second Babylon, the Republican coalition's clash with science has seeded half a dozen controversies. These include Bible-based disbelief in Darwinian theories of evolution, dismissal of global warming, disagreement with geological explanations of fossil fuel depletion, religious rejection of global population planning, derogation of women's rights, opposition to stem cell research, and so on. This suggests that U.S. society and politics may again be heading for a defining controversy, such as the Scopes trial of 1925. That embarrassment chastened fundamentalism for a generation, but the outcome of the eventual 21st century tests is hardly assured. Book buyers will understand that in these United States, volumes able to sell 200,000 or 300,000 hardcover copies are uncommon. Not rare, just uncommon. Consider then the publishing success of End Times preacher Tim LaHaye, earlier the politically shrewd founder, in 1981, of the Washington-based Council for National Policy. Beginning in 1994, LaHaye successfully co-authored a series of books on the Rapture, the Tribulation, and the Road to Armageddon that has since sold some 60 million copies in print, video, and cassette forms. Evangelist Jerry Falwell hailed it as probably the most influential religious publishing event since the Bible. Several novels of the Left Behind series rose to number one on the New York Times fiction bestseller list, and the series as a whole almost certainly reached 15 to 20 million American voters. Political aides in the Bush White House must have read several volumes, if only for pointers on constituency sentiment. In that respect, the books were highly informative. LaHaye's novels furnished hints rarely discussed by serious publications as to why George W. Bush's 2002 to 2003 call for war in Iraq included jeering at the United Nations, harped on the evil regime in Baghdad, and pretended that democracy, not oil, was the motive. LaHaye had authored essentially that plot almost a decade earlier. His evil Antichrist, who had a French financial advisor and rose to power through the United Nations, was headquartered in New Babylon, Iraq, not far from the Baghdad of Bush's arch-devil Saddam Hussein. The fictional Tribulation Force, which fought in God's name, represented goodness and had nothing to do with oil, which was one of the Antichrist's evil chessboards. 20 years ago, the New York Times would not have considered LaHaye for the bestseller list, and my scenario of his writings influencing the White House could only have been spoof. Not so today. In a late 2004 speech, the retiring television journalist Bill Moyers, himself an ordained Baptist minister, broke with polite convention. He told an audience at the Harvard Medical School that one of the biggest changes in politics in my lifetime is that the delusional is no longer marginal. It has come in from the fringe to sit in the seat of power in the Oval Office and in Congress. For the first time in our history, ideology and theology hold a monopoly of power in Washington. I would put it somewhat differently. These developments have warped the Republican Party and its electoral coalition, muted Democratic voices, and become a gathering threat to America's future. No leading world power in modern memory has become a captive, even a partial captive, of the sort of biblical inerrancy, backwater, not mainstream, that dismisses modern knowledge and science. The last parallel was in the early 17th century, when the papacy, with the agreement of Inquisitional Spain, disciplined the astronomer Galileo for saying that the sun, not the earth, was the center of our solar system. Conservative true believers will scoff. The United States is sui generis, they say, a unique and chosen nation. What did or did not happen to Rome, Imperial Spain, the Dutch Republic, and Britain is irrelevant. The catch here, alas, is that these nations also thought they were unique and that God was on their side. The revelation that he was apparently not added a further debilitating note to the later stages of each national decline. Perhaps the warfare, earthquakes, plagues, and turmoil of the early 21st century are unprecedented, but the religious believers of yesteryear also saw millennial signs in flood, plagues, famines, comets, and Mongol and Turkish invasions. Over the course of the last 25 years, I have made frequent reference to these political, economic, and historical, but not religious, precedents in several books, most recently in Wealth and Democracy, 2002. The concentration of wealth that developed in the United States in the long bull market of 1982 to 2000 was also a characteristic of the zeniths of the previous leading world economic powers as their elites pursued surfeit in Mediterranean villas or in the country house splendor of Edwardian England. This volume, to be sure, is mostly about something other than wealth. Its concluding chapters in Part 3 concentrate on the perils of debt, albeit that is also a financial excess. As we will see, wealth and debt have often overextended together in the modern trajectories of leading world economic powers. In a nation's early years, debt is a vital and creative collaborator in economic expansion. In late stages, it becomes what Mr. Hyde was to Dr. Jekyll, an increasingly dominant mood and facial distortion. The United States of the early 21st century is well into this debt-driven climactic, with some critics arguing, all too plausibly, that an unsustainable credit bubble has replaced the stock bubble that burst in 2000. Unfortunately, as my subtitle argues, three of the preeminent weaknesses displayed in these past declines have been religious excess, an outdated or declining energy and industrial base, and financialization and debt from foreign and military overstretch. The examples have been clear, and they thread my analysis in this book. The extent to which politics in the United States, and especially the governing Republican coalition, deserves much of the blame for this fatal convergence is not only the book's subject matter, but its raison d'etre. Part 1. Oil and American Supremacy. Chapter 1. Fuel and National Power. Control energy and you control the nations. Henry Kissinger. You and your predecessors in the oil and gas industry played a large part in making the 20th century the American century. Secretary of Energy Spencer Abraham, speech to the American Petroleum Institute, 2002. Not a day goes by without some new disclosure, some new bit of headline evidence that our brilliant energy success comes at great cost. Air pollution and toxic waste sites, blackouts and price spikes, fraud and corruption, and even war. The industrial strength confidence that was a byproduct of our global energy economy for most of the 20th century has slowly been replaced by anxiety. Paul Roberts, The End of Oil, 2004. The stakes could hardly be higher. Since the early 20th century, the world's age of oil has also been its era of American supremacy. Few doubt the interrelationship. Not merely a symbol of U.S. global power, petroleum has been its fuel for military might, 20th century manufacturing supremacy, and the latter-day SUV gas hog culture. Oil abundance has always been part of what America fights for, as well as with. Until recently, Americans have managed their oil age well. Like previous watershed energy regimes, ours has been an idiosyncratic mastery, a timely conjunction of a resource base, technical proficiency, and popular awareness. Put differently, over the last several hundred years, each leading global economic power has ridden an emergent fuel resource into the pages of history. From the late 18th century to the early 20th century, Britain did so through its pioneering skill with abundant coal. America's years at the helm, in turn, were driven by national engagement with the next major fossil fuel, oil. The 21st century's oil supply uncertainties have rekindled U.S. scholarly interest in the historical phenomenon of resource wars, which are now obviously looming more ominously than ever. Equally important, then, must be the strategic grasp of resource bases by modern world powers. This chapter's thesis is that unusual abilities to exploit a single energy resource for profit and for power, literal and political, have been vital to the rise of the leading world economic powers. These supremacies have overlapped with, though they have not fully paralleled, inventive relationships with decisive fuels. The downside so far has been that the country able to seize a unique energy opportunity has lacked the wherewithal to manage the next one. Thus, the inevitable 21st century global transition from oil to a post-oil regime, be it natural gas, hydrogen, more nuclear reliance, renewable energies, or various hybrids of cleaned-up fossil fuels, could see the United States displaced by a new leading economic power, probably an Asian one. China's early history of innovations in hydraulics, natural gas use, and deep drilling may be relevant. This is not to embrace some vaguely Marxian mineral determinism, linking nations' power to natural resources in a way that downplays factors such as religion, nationalism, or charismatic leadership. What seems clear is that fuel has been one of several pivots. Thereafter, over generations, the world's energy leaderships, 17th century Dutch ingenuity with water, wind, and wood, British aptitude with coal, and the U.S. cleverness with oil, have invariably developed related infrastructures of corporate, governmental, and cultural commitment. One generation's innovations become a later era's entrenchments. Britain, on the cusp of decline, naively faced the military and economic future shock of 1914 to 1945 with a sooty transportation and energy structure still rooted in the mid-Victorian commercial geography of coal fields, canals, railroads, and ironmongers. The United States, for its part, is entering the 21st century with a resource base of declining oil and gas production and a grid of aging power plants, pipelines, and refineries. Serious ledgers must also include the maintenance cost of a population blithely dispersed to suburbs and exurbs under the psychologies of cheap gas and oil that dominated in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, recently reinforced by the current migration to micropolitan areas along outer suburban interstate highway corridors. When U.S. gasoline prices reached $3 a gallon in 2005, media reports began to capture the trauma among rural, small-town, and exurban Americans who drove to distant jobs. Other legacies range from the assets inertia of oil behemoths such as ExxonMobil to the potential insolvency of the one-time Detroit automobile giants, as SUV manufacturing becomes less magically profitable than it once seemed. With U.S. oil production slumping inexorably from its 1970 peak and replacement options unclear, Americans have already embraced one historically familiar recourse: military seizure of portions of the Middle East, which by 2020 will have two-thirds of the world's remaining oil resources. Demand among other nations will press even harder than it does now. As supplies tighten, the countries of Latin America and Asia, especially China, India, and Japan, all with ballooning fuel needs, will also scheme and compete for them. Energy analysts have begun incorporating military reminders, the high past incidents of wars fought over natural resources, into some of the books published recently in North America, volumes with stark messages such as The End of Oil, On the Edge of a Perilous New World, Blood and Oil, The Dangers and Consequences of America's Growing Dependency on Imported Petroleum, The Party's Over, Oil, War, and the Fate of Industrial Societies, and Crossing the Rubicon, The Decline of the American Empire at the End of the Age of Oil. These, along with other, more technical works, marshal expert geological analyses behind the proposition that, at very least, world oil supplies will be tightening in the 2010s and 2020s, even as commercial demand mushrooms. Discussion of the American politics of this global conundrum will follow in Chapter 2, leading into analysis of the mainsprings of U.S. petroleum imperialism in Chapter 3. However, this first chapter aims to set a basic scene. The United States is a long-time oil power, at best an oil and gas power, and the aging of its energy infrastructure, guarded by a globally aggressive, entrenched interest political coalition, is a harbinger of costly confrontations and military embroilment that will lead to national decline. Human nature has hardly been remolded. Prehistoric societies were often at blows over natural resources: food, water, and wood for fire and shelter. Modern history has been only slightly more subtle. Natural resources caused or aggravated 16th, 17th, and 18th century wars to secure Baltic timber and naval stores, North Atlantic fisheries, East Indies spices, Caribbean sugar and salt, as well as New World gold and silver. After the Industrial Revolution, fossil fuels such as coal and oil moved into great power gun sites. Many resource grabs have succeeded. The broader dilemma for the 21st century United States, unfortunately, has a financial twist. Past leading powers have eventually suffered from imperial hubris, a misplaced cocksureness that leads them into a strategic overreach they can no longer afford. The result has often been a humbled hegemon, left with crippling debt burdens, lost trade advantages, a stricken currency, and increasing vulnerability as rivals increase their stature as creditor nations, financial centers, and technological innovators. To be sure, not all trends follow early-stage extrapolations. History may take decades to adjudicate whether the United States will be saluted for regaining its earlier global oil supremacy or disrespected for pursuing its ambitions into the footprints of earlier powers that miscalculated and stumbled. What can safely be said is this: the long-time proven fuel of American power is running low, and at an extraordinarily inopportune time. The consequences of this will necessarily affect the global strength of the dollar, which gives U.S. strategists a double challenge. A brief history of Western foolishness. Foolishness about fuel history deserves its own noun. Candid discussions by senior U.S. officials about the peaking of American oil production back in 1970 and the not-too-distant peaking of global output have been rare, to say the least. This cavalier behavior has ignored geologists' calculations regarding the aging and depletion of world oil resources, which have generally been proved out since the 70s. Another mistake has been to date the petroleum era. Its history, politics, and economics back no farther than 1859, when America's first oil well was drilled in northwest Pennsylvania. The implication, at least, is that there is little older precedent that matters. Politically and historically, this is myopic. Oil is no modern energy discovery. The word itself goes back to the Greek elia, which became oleum in Latin, then oil in Old French and medieval Anglo-French. The Bible, especially Genesis, has references to asphalt, tar, and naphtha. Medieval Mesopotamia and Persia had local oil bureaucrats. In Renaissance Europe, some oil came from olives, some from fish, lard, seeds, nuts, and rocks. According to some, the word petroleum, Latin for rock oil, first appeared in De Re Metallica, the 1556 treatise by German-born George Bauer, writing as Georgius Agricola, widely regarded as the father of mineralogy. Other scholars date its usage to the 14th century. So-called rock oil was produced in several parts of Germany and Eastern Europe. All of this matters. By the Middle Ages, Basques and Scandinavians were killing whales for oil in the Bay of Biscay and the North Atlantic. After Spain's Great Armada was scattered and sunk in 1588, a desperate Spanish navy pressed into service whale-wise Basque seamen. Many chose instead to sail with the Dutch, who by the 1620s wound up in control of a much expanded European whaling trade. This centered in waters around Spitsbergen, the barren 15,000-square-mile island just north of the Arctic Circle, then Dutch-held and known as Amsterdam Island. There, oil production for the lamps of Europe bred a roistering milieu not unlike that in later industrial boomtowns in the United States. By 1637, the Dutch apparently had more than 300 whaling ships and 18,000 men at Spitsbergen. The new flensing and boiling techniques developed by the Hollanders to produce whale oil created a sprawling industrial landscape resembling a seaside Hades. Endless carcasses, huge saws and knives, deep vats, row after row of storage tanks, with fires and smoke clouds lurid in the Arctic half-light. The biggest of these mammalian giants, sperm whales 60 to 70 feet long, produced a whopping 500 to 800 gallons of oil. Procuring whale oil was a serious European enterprise. The Dutch, without peer in seagoing commerce, used it for soap, lighting for streets, households and industry, lubricants for machinery, cosmetics, lipsticks and perfumes, and even sophisticated paints. Art historians credit local oil refining techniques for the mastery exhibited by the Dutch and Flemish painters of the 16th and 17th centuries. Linseed oil made from seeds crushed in nearby windmills improved paints enough that Rembrandt, Vermeer, and others could make major advances in precise lines, light, shade, and perspective. Indeed, municipal illumination took a great leap forward because of a painter, Jan van der Heyden. He invented the street lantern, which burned through a night on a mixture of processed oils. Amsterdam adopted it in the 1670s for what some historians call the first proper system of city street lighting. Only some of these uses were displaced by John D. Rockefeller's later mass production of petroleum, since that was not always the preferred ingredient or lubricant for a given purpose. Wildlife conservationists, for example, later lamented that the First World War provided a large market for explosives using glycerin from baleen whale oil provided by British and Norwegian whaling in the Antarctic. French perfumers, Swiss watchmakers, and many others continue to demand special oils. After a century, Dutch whaling and broader Dutch maritime enterprise lost its edge, and in the 1720s, leadership passed to British colonial New England, most notably Massachusetts. That state, not Pennsylvania, saw the first American energy boom. More broadly, the preeminence of Dutch, British, and American companies in the international petroleum business goes back to the whaling and maritime eras. This adds centuries to the larger U.S. and Western trajectory of economic and energy resource maturation. Our oil culture is getting old. Nantucket was the first major center, and before long, 60 American whaling ships were in the Davis Strait near Greenland. By 1768, Nantucket alone had 125 whaling ships and exported its oil directly to Britain. English and Scottish ports briefly moved ahead after the British Navy captured many American whalers during the American Revolution and the War of 1812. However, Massachusetts always bounced back in peacetime, and by 1820, New Bedford, the greatest port of all, took over, captaining the pursuit of the fierce but especially oil-rich sperm whales later immortalized by Herman Melville in Moby Dick. Absorbing the fleets of other nearby whaling centers, New Bedford in 1845 sent 10,000 seamen in more than 300 ships to bring home its greatest receipts, 158,000 barrels of sperm oil, 272,000 barrels of other whale oil, and 300,000 pounds of whale bone, much in demand for corsets and such like. Like 20th century oilmen, the Dutch, British, and New England whalers generally opened up new territories as they depleted familiar ones. The sequence of whaling grounds led from the Bay of Biscay, Greenland, and Labrador to Spitsbergen and the European Arctic, the Gulf of St. Lawrence, Brazil, Chile, the South Pacific, Japan, and by the mid-19th century, Kodiak, Kamchatka, the Bering Sea, and the nearby Alaskan Arctic. Petroleum exploration produced a similar migration of geologists. From Pennsylvania, Eastern Europe, the Russian Caucasus, and Persia to the Dutch East Indies, Oklahoma, Texas, California, Mexico, Venezuela, the Persian Gulf, Saudi Arabia, West Africa, Alaska, the North Sea, and the South China Sea. Each time, resource depletion demanded increasingly far-flung searches. The petroleum that attracted 30,000 fortune seekers to Civil War-era Pennsylvania found much the same market as whale oil. Illumination was foremost, then lubrication, soap production, medicinal remedies, and paints. The Seneca Indians who lived along Oil Creek, a tributary of the Allegheny, had long used the local oil seepage in their especially fearful war paint, a distant cousin of the medium of the Dutch masters. After Colonel Edwin Drake drilled the first local oil well in 1859, Pennsylvania businessmen acknowledged whale oil as a forerunner. The author of Petrolia, the landscape of America's first oil boom, wrote that more than any other product, whale oil whetted the human appetite for clean, efficient, and affordable illumination. The American whaling fleet defined the process of the hunt and refining technology, thereby establishing dominance over the fishery. Most importantly, this dominance established trade markets to disperse whale oil illumination internationally. Illumination proved to be so integral and basic a technology that Americans readily purchased the expensive oil. This success, however, aroused a grassroots desire for a less expensive alternative. Mid-19th century Americans were illiterate and reading people. Demand for nighttime illumination far exceeded the 4 million barrels of whale oil produced each year by refineries in New England and New York. It was for this reason that Drake's Connecticut backers sent him to the Oil Creek Valley. Journalists and entrepreneurs recognized the continuity. The first oil gushers in Venango County prompted hurrahs akin to Siemens, "Thar she blows," for the spout of a large sperm whale. In 1861, Vanity Fair published a cartoon showing formally attired whales attending a ball honoring Drake's well, pausing to toast the new technology that had spared them. Cheap and plentiful, the new fuel soon carried energy use to revolutionary levels. But these few paragraphs should make one thing clear. Oil was no physical or commercial bolt from the blue. 3 centuries of development cannot, in the words of one technology-proud U.S. oil museum, be dismissed as a few thousand barrels of kerosene produced from rock oil hand-dug by peasants in Eastern Europe. Indeed, most scholars now credit F.M. Semenov, a Russian engineer, for drilling the first oil well near Baku in the late 1840s. The dioramas and paintings of whale-crazed Spitsbergen in Amsterdam's Rijksmuseum portray one of the earliest serious industrial landscapes. From Romania to Norway, from bamboo-drilling China to the flowing springs along the Caspian Sea that so impressed Marco Polo, the medieval period had known oil in many varieties. Greek fire, similar to napalm, was a famous war weapon. And even 2 prominent early versions of the internal combustion engine, portal to the peak oil era, used lesser fuels. Henry Ford's original Model T burned ethanol made from corn, and Rudolf Diesel's 1892 invention was designed to run on peanut or vegetable oil, both easily made. In the modern age of oil geopolitics after World War I, it was not coincidental that Britain and the Netherlands, along with the well-endowed United States, owned the preeminent oil giants, the famous Seven Sisters. Esso, Texaco, Saucony, SoCal, Gulf Oil, British Petroleum, then the Anglo-Persian Oil Company, and Royal Dutch Shell. For Britain and Holland, the explanation lay in maritime and imperial history. The legacy of far-flung empires and spheres of interest. During the 1890s, the oil fields that grew into Royal Dutch were found in the Dutch East Indies archipelago that traders from Holland had originally seized for spices in the 1620s. The Caribbean islands of the Dutch Antilles, colonized in the 1630s in pursuit of trade and salt deposits, also paid off 300 years later. Some oil was found locally, and Royal Dutch obtained concessions for the rich new oil fields in next-door Venezuela. Huge and profitable refineries went up on the Dutch island of Aruba. Imperial reach also gave Britain access to Persia in particular, as well as to Borneo, Burma, and Trinidad, along with several protected Persian Gulf sultanates. The handicap of the coal-rich British was then a 19th-century dearth of curiosity about petroleum. Despite some early exploration in central Burma, serious attention did not develop until the Anglo-German naval and strategic rivalry that gripped both nations after 1900. Until then, Persia and Mesopotamia were principally way stations to India, the distant jewel in Britain's imperial crown. When the British struck oil in Persia in 1908, it was at the site of the ancient fire temple at Masjid Suleiman. The explorer responsible, mining engineer William Darcy, was also an avid Bible reader, his interest piqued by scriptural reference to the naphtha pools that burned endlessly in ancient fire temples. Darcy's find soon led to the Anglo-Persian Oil Company, which later became Anglo-Iranian, and ultimately British Petroleum. But considering that a French archaeologist had found local oil seepages in 1892, and that reports to England of large quantities of oil in Persia dated back to the 16th century, the British were slow to act. Britain had all the coal it needed for industry and commerce, so oil initially became important because of naval needs. Awareness in the United States had much deeper economic antecedents. As we will see, the oil finds of the 1920s were too little and too late to resurrect Dutch and British global economic hegemonies, each of which had a trajectory of 125 to 140 years. Britons simply did not have the feel for oil that they had for coal. The fact that the Americans, British, and Dutch all have oil assets and are close allies in the 21st century may not matter much in resolving the next pivotal issue: whether the all-important U.S. oil infrastructure and culture can transform itself. The clock is clearly ticking. The political establishment's reluctance to acquaint the American electorate with this dilemma involves three particularly glaring problems. 1. Unwillingness to speak of the present oil crisis in the full context of geological, economic, and military history. 2. Failure to understand the past vulnerability of great but idiosyncratic national energy cultures losing their familiar footing. And 3, refusal to discuss the evidence of oil field depletions and insufficient new discoveries that shows petroleum production moving toward an inflammatory worldwide shortage in a matter of decades. Candor is rare, and its lack costly in such watersheds, having also been scarce in the Dutch United Provinces circa 1720 and in Britain just a century ago. The dead hand of yesteryear's success. The evidence is that leading world economic powers, after an energy golden era, lose their magic, and not by accident. The infrastructures created by these unusual successes eventually become economic obstacle courses and inertia-bound burdens. This chapter's emphasis will be on the United States as the vulnerable oil hegemon, an essential perspective for evaluating developments both in domestic politics and about the American military protectorate in Iraq. However, this is best prefaced by a brief look at what made and then undid the United Provinces of the Netherlands as the wind and water hegemon from 1590 to the 1720s, and what made and then, more important, unmade Britain as the coal hegemon from roughly 1760 to 1914. More was involved than merely fuel, but the rise of coal-based industry left the Dutch further behind and elevated Britain. Oil, in turn, played a major role in the U.S. displacement of Britain. Simon Schama, the historian, interpreted Holland's 17th century golden age as a triumph of moral geography. The small seaside United Provinces of the Netherlands, with so much of its surface area in islands and reclaimed land, represented a victory of people over water. Infirmity into strength, water into dry land, mud into gold. He argued further that hydrology and reformed religion went together. Even as the Protestant Hollanders redeemed their country in the 1580s and 1590s by expelling Spanish Catholic rulers, they were reclaiming hundreds of thousands of acres from the sea. Both redemptions fed a sense of being special. "The making of new land belongs to God alone," proclaimed 16th century hydraulic engineer Andries Vierling, "for he gives to some people the wit and strength to do it." Actually, the Dutch achievement went even further. From the 1580s until the disruptive European Wars of 1688 to 1713, the Dutch built the foremost global trading empire of that time. Tamers of the seas, they were also the best designers of ships. From small, handy trading vessels, flights, to whaling ships and herring buses. The Dutch led in navigation. They ran the lucrative herring fisheries and North Atlantic whale trade. Their navy dominated the sea lanes to Asia, and their engineers penned up the waters of the Zuider Zee with dikes, hydraulics, and windmill-driven pumps. At their peak, the Dutch boasted the world's biggest shipyards, the global center of commerce and finance, Amsterdam, the largest share of world trade, and overseas outposts from Brazil to New Amsterdam and from Japan, China, and India to the Cape of Good Hope. More than just a communications network and global highway, water for the Dutch was also a sea of riches. Herring, cod, whales, polder that became farmland, and salt, the vital preservative. Flooding itself became a weapon, used to trap or keep out Spanish troops when Dutch generals retreated behind their inner waterline. Leiden University, in 1600, established a school for fortification engineers that taught water warfare. Not surprisingly, a Hollander invented a powerful type of fire engine, pipes as thick as a person's thigh, powered by pumps able to throw water 300 paces. But water was not the only source of Dutch power. By filling the sails of the world's largest merchant marine, estimates ranged from 6,000 ships to an unlikely 10,000, wind also drove the single most important element of the Dutch economy. Flat and breezy Holland also harnessed air currents to drive the machinery of several thousand windmills. Following the 17th century updating of the camshaft and crankshaft, these workhorses attained a surprising sophistication. The first Dutch oilseed grinding mill was established in 1582, the first paper mill in 1586, and the first timber sawing mill in 1592. By the early 18th century, the best mills were equipped with automatic regulators that controlled the speed of rotation, adjusted the pitch of the fan blades for maximum power at a given wind speed, and oriented the fan so that it faced directly into the wind. 51 Alkmaar mills used for drainage could pump out water at a combined rate of 1,000 cubic meters per minute, the volume equivalent of a swimming pool 100 feet long and wide and 5 feet deep. In Zaan, Europe's principal industrial district, nearly 1,000 windmills powered large-scale shipbuilding, as well as the precursors of the food, paper, and timber works still located there. By the mid-18th century, as commercial and military power passed to industrializing Britain and populous France, Holland's importance in trade and production was waning. Dutch seamanship, fisheries, and shipbuilding all had lost their earlier reputations by 1750. Specialists in Dutch history offer many explanations. Some have emphasized war and rivals' mercantilist economic policies, the cumulative damage done to Dutch trade routes and maritime capacity by the late 17th century and 18th century wars with France, together with the tariffs or outright prohibitions imposed by many countries on certain foreign goods, all of which hurt Dutch industries and shipping. The diffusion of Dutch technical expertise across Europe was also a problem. So was the reorientation of many Hollanders toward investments rather than hands-on commerce, seamanship, or engineering. Most historians agree that Dutch maritime and technical endeavors became less likely to innovate, and the British in particular moved ahead. Moreover, the Republic had negligible coal and iron deposits, whereas well-supplied Britain was about to knit the two together in the Industrial Revolution. Coal, iron, and the steam engine overwhelmed the windmills that had been so advanced 2 centuries earlier. The British era dated from 1763 and the defeat of France after 7 years of war. Coal was already putting its dusty fingerprints on Britain's economic future. Indeed, one scholar calls that prowess notable enough that an early coal-fired first industrial revolution took place in the England of the 17th century. No other 18th century nation remotely matched Britain in coal resources and knowing what to do with them. Mines in northern England had begun shipping substantial cargoes to London by sea during the reign of Queen Elizabeth. Despite its acrid smoke, coal was used for heat and to assist in glassmaking, brickmaking, dyeing, ironworking, and metallurgy. In mining regions, it frequently replaced wood, which was becoming scarce and cost 2 to 3 times more. By 1700, England burned 2.5 million tons of coal each year, the great bulk of Europe's consumption. To one French visitor in the 1720s, coal was the soul of English manufactures for serving so many trades and domestic purposes elsewhere, still fueled by wood. The major innovations that made coal the grand enabler of industry were all British. Blacksmith Thomas Newcomen developed the first steam engine, installed in 1712 to pump water from a coal mine. In 1769, James Watt built a pump that was much more powerful and thus usable in all kinds of factories, not just mines with nearly free coal at hand. In the 1780s, the development of the puddling and rolling processes consummated the ability to smelt pig iron with coke, coal baked to burn off impurities, which made possible the shift of furnaces and foundries from remote forests to what would become large industrial districts near coal fields. Transportation as well as iron making came to be concentrated in the coal fields. A path-breaking English canal, completed by the Duke of Bridgewater in 1761, linked his coal mines at Worsley to the fledgling industrial center of Manchester. The cost of coal there dropped by half. Other coal-carrying waterways followed. Tracks of iron-reinforced wood, laid in the late 18th century to carry coal-bearing wagons from the mines to the rivers and seaports, inspired the idea of replacing horses with coal-burning steam engines. In the 1810s, George Stephenson, a colliery engine wright, perfected what became the first locomotive. By 1830, the island kingdom mined four-fifths of the world's coal, and in 1848 produced more iron than the rest of the world put together. Taken together, coal, iron, steam engines, and railways were the Industrial Revolution. By the end of the 19th century, more than half of the British towns of more than 50,000 people were situated on or near coal fields. The regional redistribution of English population in the 18th and 19th centuries to the North and Midlands was likewise coal-driven, historians agree. This was also the zenith of British invention, much of it by skilled craftsmen and engineers, not men of scientific learning. Because of this idiosyncratic imprint, British metallurgy, to take one example, was mostly a collection of small family firms, the sort that cherished and maintained old machinery. Large-scale U.S. and German iron and steel enterprises, backstopped by research laboratories and technically attuned university systems, cut a new swath in the early 1900s and left British competition behind. Cambridge historian Corelli Barnett, in The Collapse of British Power, wryly described Britain circa 1914 as, in many ways, a working museum of industrial archaeology. Here clanked on tirelessly not only the actual machines, but, not so tirelessly, the techniques and outlook of 1815 to 1850. Marvels of inventiveness and progress in their epoch, but transformed by the passage of time into quaint memorials of the original Industrial Revolution. Some still survive in popular British museums, a fate also overtaking the machinery of U.S. oil and automobile culture. By Queen Victoria's death, coal mining itself was more efficient in Germany and America. Despite large-scale British production, many mines were old, with the cheaper-to-reach coal already taken. The most revealing dimension involved coal derivatives, which until the 1850s had been a British-dominated field. A geologist in coal-rich Scotland had extracted sal ammoniac from soot in 1756, and two decades later, another Scot began the exploitation of coal as a source of coal tar and chemicals. Coal gas for illumination, developed in the 1790s, was first used to light British factories at night during the Napoleonic Wars. As late as 1856, William H. Perkin, a trained chemist, discovered the first aniline dye based on coal distillation. Thereafter, innovation shifted to Germany, abetted by British willingness to export large quantities of coal tar. By 1914, drugs and dyestuffs had become a German near monopoly and prime export. Much the same materials were critical for making high explosives. According to the post-war history of the British Ministry of Munitions, In August 1914, therefore, the Germans were in the fortunate position of being able to turn with ease the vast resources of a flourishing coal-tar industry to the production of high explosives. Britain, in short, had been left at the gate. The spirit of Newcomen, Darby, and Perkin had been missing for at least a generation. Just as the Dutch had been left behind by the 18th century Industrial Revolution, some economic historians suggest that coal-shaped Britain was left behind by a second Industrial Revolution, circa 1900, that elevated chemicals, petroleum, and electrical engineering, all industries requiring large firms, scientific laboratories, educated workforces, and economies of scale. Whatever one calls the transformation, the Britain of 1900 to 1914 lagged, with a handful of explanations prevailing. As the inevitable consequence of having gone first, late 19th century Britain had a huge investment in plants, equipment, and early techniques that were outdated a generation or two later. Trouble also lay with the prominence of family firms run by engineers, tinkerers, and craftsmen ill-equipped to make the transition to economies of scale and mass marketing. The unplanned structure of railroads, in turn, was so widely acknowledged a drag by 1872 that both the British Inspector of Railways and The Economist called for state ownership as a remedy. Critics also dwelt on how the estate-owning elite of the time looked askance at industry, science, and technology, favoring instead the sort of education that trained the next generation to read Greek and Latin and prepare for Parliament or the Indian Civil Service. Planning and efficiency, alien in this infrastructure, became a much criticized deficit of early 20th century Britain. A group of leading academic and public figures who called themselves the Coefficients, organized to discuss possible solutions, including the formation of a national efficiency party under former Prime Minister Lord Rosebery. To sum up, by 1914, Britain's energy infrastructure had gone from dominance to incipient crisis in a single century. After World War II, when the coal industry was finally nationalized, one commentator described the nation's prime resource base this way: psychologically and physically, it was in a dreadful state. The legacy of the pre-war period was not only an old-fashioned, ill-equipped, and inefficient industry, but a store of bitterness and suspicion in the heart of the miner against the treatment he had received at the hands of the colliery owner. History repeats only in outline, so the United States must find its own pathway. But the general parallel is the basis for worry. The United States began the 21st century as the leading world economic power, but one already 80 to 100 years into an oil and gas-related dominion. Some symptoms of aging, like the displacement of manufacturing by finance, were already writ large in gross domestic product data. The conventional energy infrastructure, from pipelines to refineries, was already being described by private and government experts as partly outdated, difficult to overhaul, and vulnerable to attack and sabotage. But there was also an aging problem right at the heart of America's once globally preeminent oil and gas resources: the aging American energy infrastructure. Like the British of 1900, Americans a century later were slow to grasp the possibility that a steep price might have to be paid for the graying temples of what had once been a pioneering fuel culture and infrastructure. 21st century oil rests on more than corporations, plants, and pipelines. Any realistic catalog must also include government subsidies and preferences, entrenched bureaucracies and interest groups, foreign relationships, political party coalitions, and recurring Middle East war patterns. These will be discussed in the next two chapters. This one, however, will look at the physical and economic causes and symptoms of sclerosis. The sheer age of the U.S. oil industry, a zenith and depletion of U.S. oil and gas reserves, the so-called Hubbert Peak, the structural weakness of the huge U.S.-based international oil corporations, superannuated Goliaths desperate for Middle East oil, and the weakness of U.S. automotive giants, which have lost most markets save those for trucks, large cars, and sports utility vehicles. In the long history of oil in the United States, coal was a short-lived rival. Despite resources larger than Britain's, the United States never became a true coal culture. That was because settlers, for some 250 years after the settlements at Jamestown and Plymouth, kept moving west, clearing land and cutting down trees. Sheer availability made the new nation a wood-burning culture. Even in the centennial year of 1876, the United States took twice as much energy from firewood as from coal. Coal pulled ahead in the mid-1880s, cresting as a source of three-quarters of U.S. energy in 1910, when oil was already beginning its rapid military and industrial ascent. Unfashionable and dangerous to mine, coal put its industrial-era stamp on only a few regions, principally Appalachia and kindred southern portions of Ohio, Indiana, and Illinois. Oil, with its romance and overnight opportunity, caught the American fancy from the start. So avidly did New Englanders pursue whales for their prized oil that in 1775, the British statesman Edmund Burke saluted their pluck on the floor of Parliament. "And pray, sir, what in the world is equal to it? No sea but what is vexed by their fisheries, no climate that is not witness to their toils." The 1859 find in Pennsylvania, in turn, promoted the biggest oil boom since Spitsbergen, but few local residents were too surprised. Cartographers had been recording petroleum in Pennsylvania since Lewis Evans's 1755 map of the middle British colonies. 16th-century Spaniards had found puddles in Louisiana and oil slicks off the coast of California. A folk culture was gestating. Native Americans recommended oil to soldiers during the American Revolution as a cure for frostbite. George Washington himself bought an oil spring in 1771. Many other early 19th-century venturers put it in lamps and medicine bottles, probably including John D. Rockefeller's father, a quack who peddled patent medicines. In what became the oil regions, small springs and seeps were commonplace. In addition to Pennsylvania's Oil Creek and West Virginia's Kanawha River, Old Greasy, oil had turned up in Kentucky, Ohio, and other parts of western Pennsylvania, frequently as a byproduct of searching or drilling for salt. Rockefeller himself was caught up in more than simple greed in the post-Civil War years when his Standard Oil Company, formed in 1870 in Cleveland, ruthlessly suppressed the chaos of competition among oil refiners. Order of some kind was necessary. Unlike coal, petroleum was subject to disastrous overproduction, which periodically collapsed prices. The Pennsylvania oil fields initially became a mecca for gamblers and speculators, bringing Titusville and Oil City local oil exchanges by 1871. Ida Tarbell, a daughter of the Pennsylvania oil fields who went on to write the history of the Standard Oil Company, said of the fortune hunters, "Life ran swift and ruddy and joyous in these men. People danced to such tunes as the American Petroleum Polka and the Oil Fever Gallop." More than silver, more than gold, oil was the enterprise through which Americans of the industrial era could strike pay dirt, and, as exploration moved westward, many did. Western Pennsylvania led to Ohio and then to Kansas. As early as 1851, Kit Carson and Jim Bridger discovered an oil spring at Poison Spider Creek, just west of present-day Casper, Wyoming. In 1861, lured by news of oil seepage in California, Demetrius Schofield packed up and left the Pennsylvania fields. In 1876, he bought the California Star Oil Works north of the little town of Los Angeles and went on to become the first president of Standard Oil of California. Coal built few large fortunes. But by the turn of the 20th century, the oil men, and in a decade more, automobile makers such as Henry Ford and Horace Dodge, topped the lists of great American wealth, a superiority that peaked in the early 1980s following a decade of steep hikes in the price of petroleum. At the century's end, oil money was half Texas crude and half Eastern refined. Mellow, leather-bound fortunes steeped in the fourth and fifth generation respectability of Rockefeller foundations, Mellon art collections, and Harkness pavilions. In the 1920s, British visitors were already struck by oil's pervasiveness in American culture. Two of them, E. H. Davenport and S. R. Cook, set down this 1923 comparison. Travel but a little in the country and you will gain the impression that the modernism of the United States flowed from its oil wells. Outwardly, oil occupies there the place which coal occupies in Great Britain. The oil field derrick is as familiar a landmark to the American as the pit head wheels to the worker in our black country. The oil tank car is as ubiquitous on his railroads as the coal truck is on ours. His wayside is dotted with the petrol pump, and at night illuminated oil filling stations make his streets beautiful. A network of oil pipelines underlies his country, more extensive than the network of railways overlying ours. Does not the American partly live in oil? Certainly many Americans spent long hours in oil-powered vehicles. As automobiles took over from horses and buggies after World War I, they outstripped equine muscle with 40, 75, and 120 horsepower engines. In 1929, the United States was estimated to have more than two-thirds of the world's cars. The Germans, incurably mechanical, described the American economic and cultural giddiness of the 1920s in automotive terms. Fordismus. By 1950, Americans were consuming more than one-third of the world's energy output and nearly half of its oil, with gasoline as the single leading product. Nearly two-thirds of U.S. oil consumption was in this form. No oil expert could ignore the great American automobile craze. In 2004, after the United States had ruled global automobile ownership for a century, it was still a truism that having a car is a way of assimilating in America, and more often than not, it's also the only way of getting around. Public transit systems are rarely found outside of the cities, and they carry with them the stigma of catering to those people who can't afford a car. With the automobile being such a necessity and also a symbol of status, is it any wonder that America views life through a car windshield? Along with highways, service stations, motels, and such, the American oil infrastructure also enabled and supported major demographic and residential change, as seen in the extraordinary 20th century remolding of U.S. population distribution. To make the obvious analogy, it paralleled in magnitude, if not flow, the redistribution that coal had wrought in Britain. Following the huge 1901 Spindletop oil discovery in Gulf Coast, Texas, when wells able to produce 100,000 barrels per day dwarfed previous 5,000 barrel capabilities, Americans concluded that supply was enormous, verging on endless. Two more decades ushered in the petro landscape described by Davenport and Cook. Coal continued to lead for a while in percentage terms, but America's prevailing 20th century corporate, transportation, energy, and residential infrastructure was being shaped around petroleum. A century later, Spindletop's glories were only a recollection, like the boom times of Oil City, Pennsylvania. It lived on as a museum, 15 old buildings from the boom years. As for the huge East Texas fields discovered in the late 1920s and early 1930s, Daisy Bradford No. 3, Lathrop No. 1, and the rest, by 2004, production there had fallen from 160 million barrels a year in 1936 to just 10 million. In Midland, the oil capital of the West Texas Permian Basin, the major companies began leaving the area in 2000, and some studies suggest that the local oil industry will be gone by the 2020s. The U.S. oil industry is very old, Paul Holtberg, a senior researcher with the RAND Corporation, cautioned in 2002. There's no question that the resource here has been drilled more heavily than anywhere else in the world. Back in 1956, Marion King Hubbert, an American geologist working for Shell, had brought out a set of calculations interrelating the dates of the major U.S. oil field discoveries, their rates of production, and the peaks that he saw inevitably following. Fossil fuels such as oil, natural gas, and coal, squeezed into being by millions of years of massive pressure on concentrations of animal and plant matter, are not renewable. Using geological computations, Hubbert predicted that extraction of oil in the lower 48 states, Alaska had not yet been tapped, would maximize between 1965 and 1970. To the surprise of laymen, the peak did come in 1970, after which overall production in the lower 48 dropped steadily, despite all sorts of new tax breaks and breakthroughs in drilling technology. By the time Hubbert died in 1989, he had attracted numerous disciples, many grouped in a professional organization called the Association for the Study of Peak Oil and